November 15th, 1971, Galveston, Texas. 15-year-old Debbie Ackerman and 15-year-old Maria Johnson are seen climbing into a white van outside an ice cream shop, but they never return home. Days later, the girls' bodies are found in a bayou, and they are bound, nude from the waist down, and have been shot to death. After several decades, a convicted murderer named Edward Harold Bell sends out letters in which he confesses to having killed Debbie and Maria. Bell claims to be responsible for the murders of 11 female victims in Texas during the 1970s and refers to them as the 11 who went to heaven, but none of these cases are conclusively solved. After that, the trail went cold. Hello, everyone, and welcome to part two of our special 7-year anniversary episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and today I'll be picking up where we left off last week and continuing our series about 11 murder victims known as the 11 who went to heaven. The victims in question were 11 girls between the ages of 12 and 19 who were all killed within the same Tri-County area of Texas during the 1970s. After a convicted murderer named Edward Harold Bell confessed all these crimes decades later, he referred to them as the 11 who went to heaven. On last week's episode, we focused primarily on the murders of two of these victims, Rhonda Renee Johnson and Sharon Shaw, as a suspect named Michael Lloyd Self was charged and convicted of that crime. However, Self's arrest was made possible by a confession which he claimed had been coerced from him by corrupt cops, and Self never stopped maintaining his innocence until he died in prison in 2000. While Edward Harold Bell, who was serving a 70-year prison sentence for the 1978 murder of a man named Larry Dickens, eventually started implying that he was the real killer of Rhonda Renee Johnson and Sharon Shaw, and also took credit for the unsolved murders of 9 other victims, which took place in that region of Texas between 1971 and 1977. Bell's claims eventually captured the attention of a retired homicide detective named Fred Page and an investigative reporter named Lisa Olson, who decided to perform a deep dive into all these crimes and look for potential evidence which implicated Bell. Their findings would be chronicled in a 6-part true crime series titled The 11, which aired on the A&E network in 2017. The murders would also be extensively chronicled in a 2015 book written by author Catherine Casey, titled Deliver Us, 3 Decades of Murder and Redemption in the Infamous I-45 Texas Killing Fields. And this book and the 11 TV series are going to be the primary sources of information on this episode. Since our last episode provided a thorough account of the Rhonda Renee Johnson, Sharon Shaw case, this episode is going to focus on the murders of the other 9 victims. I'll be discussing each of the crimes one by one and sharing Bell's possible connections to them before I provide my own theories and analysis about this whole situation. Anyway, without any further ado, let us now continue the saga of the 11 who went to heaven. Our story begins in Texas in 1971, and our first two victims are 15-year-old Debbie Ackerman and 15-year-old Maria Johnson. Both girls live in Galveston, and even though Maria originally hails from Georgia and had only moved to the area 1 year earlier, she quickly became best friends with Debbie. They instantly bonded over their mutual love of such activities as surfing and water skiing, as Debbie often competed in surfing contests and had won her first trophy in one of them during the summer. After spending the night at Maria's house, the girls woke up on the morning of Monday, November the 15th, and since this happened to be a school holiday, they wanted to head downtown while Maria's mother and stepfather went to work. The two friends were given permission to do this, though Debbie's father instructed her to be home by 3:15. At around 11:15 a.m., Debbie and Maria went to a Baskin-Robbins ice cream shop near the Port Holiday Mall and spoke with one of the employees, Cindy Thompson, who happened to be a friend of the two girls. According to Cindy, the girls told her that they wanted to hitchhike to Houston, and when they left the shop and stuck their thumb out, a white van pulled over. Cindy said that the van had a sticker of a peace symbol on the back window and was being driven by a white male. After the man spoke with Debbie and Maria, they both climbed inside his van and it drove off, but this would turn out to be the last time they were confirmed to be alive. Debbie did not return home as instructed by 3:15, and when her father called Maria's house, it turned out that neither of the girls were there either. When they failed to resurface by the following morning, their families contacted the Galveston Police Department in order to report them missing. Now, if you search through the newspaper archives, some of the original articles state that Debbie and Maria went to a shopping mall near Texas City in order to buy a birthday gift for Debbie's boyfriend before they returned to Galveston in a taxicab. But Debbie soon realized that she left her purse in the back seat of the cab and went to a taxi stand to reclaim it at 8 p.m. If this account was accurate, it would seem to poke a hole in the theory that the driver of the white van was responsible for the girl's disappearance. But according to the aforementioned Catherine Casey book, Deliver Us, Debbie actually left her purse in a taxicab and reclaimed it on the evening of Sunday, November the 14th, rather than Monday, November the 15th, so this incident probably has no relevance to the case. The girls would remain missing for 2 days, until a fisherman found Maria's body floating in Turner Bayou next to a deserted remote bridge on Humble Camp Road, located about 9 miles outside of Galveston. She was nude from the waist down, had her hands and feet bound with fishing twine, and had been shot in the head and the neck. It was estimated that Maria was in the water for approximately 36 hours at that point, meaning that she would not have been killed until 10 to 18 hours after she was last seen at the ice cream shop. Since Debbie could not be found, this prompted the authorities to perform a search of the bayou, and the following day, they discovered her body in a grassy marsh about 150 feet away from where Maria had been found. Like Maria, Debbie was nude from the waist down, had her hands and feet bound with shoelaces, and had been shot in the chin and the back. It was believed that both girls may have been standing in the water while they were shot, execution style, by someone standing on the bridge, and a witness would recall hearing what sounded like gunshots in the area sometime on the evening of November the 15th. Due to the level of decomposition on the victims' bodies, the medical examiner was unable to conclusively determine if they had been sexually assaulted. So, as you recall from our last episode, Rhonda Renee Johnson and Sharon Shaw were still missing persons at this point, as they had vanished after traveling to Galveston from their hometown of Webster in August of 1971, though their remains were not actually found until early 1972. In the days following the discovery of Debbie and Maria's bodies, the remains of two other murdered female victims would be found in adjacent Harris County, and we'll be talking more about them momentarily. But the whole situation created fear that there might be a serial killer operating in the area who was preying on teenage girls. Anyway, to provide a brief recap on Edward Harold Bell's situation, after being charged with the murder of Larry Dickens in Pasadena, Texas in August of 1978, he was released on bond to await trial, but used this opportunity to flee the country, and he remained a wanted fugitive for over 14 years until he was finally captured in Panama in February of 1993. Bell was subsequently convicted of Larry's murder and sent to prison, but in 1998, he started mailing out letters to prosecutors in Galveston County and Harris County, in which he confessed to the unsolved murders of 7 female victims which took place in those counties during the 1970s. When Bell was interviewed about this years later, he claimed that he was actually responsible for murdering 11 female victims, not 7, which is where the whole 11 who went to heaven phrase came from. Even though Bell claimed that he did not remember the names of many of his victims, he specifically mentioned Debbie Ackerman and Maria Johnson and seemed to have a detailed knowledge of their murders. So now let's go over some of the circumstantial evidence which might link Bell to this crime. During his confession letter, Bell claimed that he shot the two girls with a .357 Magnum, and while the murder weapon was never found, it was established that the bullets used to kill them were .38 caliber, which could be fired from a .357 Magnum. In 1971, Bell and his second wife were living in a rented apartment at a waterfront house in Galveston located next to Offutt's Bayou. Debbie and Maria were last seen climbing into a white van being driven by an unidentified male outside a Baskin-Robbins ice cream shop in Galveston, and yes, Bell did own a white Ford van during that time period, which he often used for his job as a traveling pharmaceutical salesman. This detail was corroborated by police records, because in February of 1972, just 3 months after Debbie and Maria were murdered, Bell was driving his van through Greta, Louisiana on a sales trip when he was arrested for exposing himself to a 15-year-old girl. It's also been reported that Bell eventually repainted his van and burned it before he started driving a rented Volkswagen, a detail which will come into play later on. When Fred Page took over the investigation decades later, he asked the public to come forward if they had any photographs of Bell's van from that time period, but it doesn't sound like this ever happened. He wanted to check if the van had a sticker of a peace symbol on the back window, as Cindy Thompson had reported seeing that on the van which picked up Debbie and Maria. During his time living in Galveston, Bell decided to invest in an establishment named Doug's Dive and Surf Shop and became a silent partner with the owner, Doug Prunz. Due to their interest in surfing, Debbie and Maria often frequented Doug's Dive and Surf Shop, so it's possible that Bell could have crossed paths with them there at some point. One of Debbie's friends also claimed that during the summer of 1971, they often spent time at the waterfront house where Bell's apartment was located, as the owner of this house was a diving instructor whom they were acquainted with. It's never been conclusively established if Debbie and Maria ever met Bell, but if they knew him, they may have felt more comfortable accepting a ride from him while hitchhiking. Now, when he was interviewed about the case decades later, Bell kept changing his story, and at one point, he denied killing the two girls, but still admitted that he picked them up at the ice cream shop and gave them a ride before dropping them off. Bell also said that when Debbie and Maria got into his van, they told him that they were tired of going to bed with high school boys and wanted an older man like him, which I'm sure is a complete crock. Also, to provide a tie-in to the Rhonda Renee Johnson Sharon Shaw case, it's worth noting that Bell's apartment in Galveston was located just down the block from the Wick Ski School, which Renee and Sharon visited on the morning they went missing. And according to one of their friends, in the weeks prior to their disappearance, Renee and Sharon had been hanging out with two unidentified older men in their 20s or 30s and were talking about running away with them to California, and one of these men apparently owned a van. So the next victim I want to talk about is 13-year-old Colette Wilson, as Bell also specifically mentioned her name during his confessions. Even though Colette went missing 5 months before Debbie and Maria were killed, her remains were not actually found until a week and a half afterwards. Colette hailed from a family where she was the second oldest of 10 children and lived near the town of Alvin, located in Brazoria County, over 30 miles northwest of Galveston. Colette played clarinet in her school band, and on June the 17th, 1971, she attended a band competition in Stafford. Since her mother, Claire Wilson, was too busy taking care of her other kids to attend, Colette's band instructor offered to drive her most of the way home and drop her off at the intersection of Highway 6 and County Road 99, which was a short distance from her house, and Claire would come pick her up there. On a side note, this location was only 11 miles away from the bridge where Debbie and Maria's bodies were later found. The band instructor said that he dropped Colette off at the intersection at 12:30 p.m., but Claire was running behind and had not yet arrived. By the time Claire did show up 6 minutes later, Colette was already gone. While she was there, Claire recalled seeing a black old model car parked along the road in the distance. There was a white male in the driver's seat, and while Claire noticed a dark-haired female in the back seat, she was unable to tell if it was Colette. Claire was not initially concerned, as she just assumed that Colette had gone to a friend's house, but when she learned that Colette was not there and could not find her anywhere, Colette was reported missing to the police. Even though the authorities were initially inclined to believe that Colette had run away voluntarily, they did eventually launch a large search effort, though no trace of Colette could be found. But in a cruel twist of fate, the murder of another young victim would inadvertently pave the way to a resolution and Colette's disappearance. On October the 28th, 19-year-old Gloria Gonzalez, who worked as a bookkeeper at a Kroger grocery store in Houston, vanished after leaving her apartment on Jacqueline Drive and was reported missing by her roommate. 3.5 weeks later, on November the 23rd, the headless, decomposing body of a young woman was found in a wooded area near the Attix Reservoir, about 35 miles west of Houston. A 2-foot length of cotton cord was attached to a 4-inch long piece of wood, which was cinched around the victim's neck, leading to speculation that she had been strangled to death with this ligature. When the police were summoned to the scene, they wound up finding a skull a short distance away from the body, which they initially assumed belonged to the same victim. A jawbone and some loose teeth were also found, but when the medical examiner attempted to reconstruct the lower jaw, he was surprised to discover that some of the teeth did not fit and likely belonged to an entirely different person. This prompted the authorities to return to the area on November the 26th to perform a more extensive search, and they came across the skeletal remains of an additional female victim 150 feet away from where the first victim had been found. This particular victim did not have a skull, but their jawbone was still intact, and one of their finger bones had a ring with the word peace on it, matching the description of a ring that Colette Wilson happened to be wearing on the day she went missing. Since Colette's father, Tom Wilson, happened to be a dentist and had personally done work on his daughter's teeth, he was asked to examine the jawbone. Tom immediately recognized some fillings in the teeth and positively identified the jawbone as belonging to Colette. Investigators soon found a decomposing head in a brush located 25 feet away from where the decomposing body had been found, and they were finally able to identify the first victim as Gloria Gonzalez. It now seemed apparent that the skull found near Gloria's body actually belonged to Colette, and since there were no signs of decapitation on the two victims, their heads had likely been detached and moved around by animals. Colette's exact cause of death could not be determined, but there were some fractures on her skull to suggest that she might have died from blunt force trauma. Since Gloria and Colette did not have any known connection to each other and went missing from different locations 4 months apart, it was theorized that they had both been murdered by the same individual who decided to dispose of their bodies in the same area. Colette's death was just the first in a long line of horrible tragedies which hit the Wilson family, as one of her brothers, John, died in 1974 at the age of 20, and her father, Tom, succumbed to a heart attack in July of 1975 at the age of 44, as many felt that the trauma of losing his daughter caused him to die of a broken heart. If that wasn't enough, the Wilsons went on to have another son named Ethan, but wound up losing him in April of 1976 when he was only 16 months old, as a family friend accidentally ran him over while backing out of the driveway. So now let's get back to Edward Harold Bell and his possible culpability in these two crimes. Other than the fact that Bell mentioned Colette's name during his confession, there is really nothing to link them together, but it's worth noting that Bell played in marching bands during high school and university. This is nothing more than pure speculation, but one theory which has been pushed forward is that Bell could have attended the band competition in Stafford that Colette participated in, and after she caught his eye, she could have followed Colette to where the instructor dropped her off at the intersection of Highway 6 and County Road 99. He then proceeded to abduct Colette in his own vehicle before her mother arrived. It's also worth noting that when Colette went missing, she was carrying a black case containing her clarinet and some sheet music, but these items were never recovered. Now, I previously mentioned that Bell claimed he did not know the names of many of his other victims, but he did say that at least one of them was from Houston, and he believed that she had the initials GG. And since Gloria Gonzalez had those initials, and her body was found in the same area as Colette's remains, investigators suspect that she was one of the 11 who went to heaven. There's nothing that conclusively links Bell to Gloria, but he did have an office in Houston during the 1970s, which he used to sell real estate, and he apparently did have business connections in the neighborhood where Gloria lived. Bell also spent a lot of time commuting between Houston and Galveston on Interstate 45, and many of these victims were found along that corridor. And speaking of Houston, that's where our next victim hailed from. The only other name Bell mentioned during his confessions was a girl he knew as Pitchford, as he claimed he had abducted her near the Gulfgate Mall in Houston. And sure enough, a 16-year-old girl named Kimberly Pitchford went missing on January the 3rd, 1973. At 5:30 p.m. that day, Kim completed a driver's education class at J. Frank Dobie High School and was supposed to call her parents from a payphone to ask them to come pick her up, but they never heard from her. In retrospect, Kim's mother believed that she may have been on the phone when her daughter attempted to call her, so if she got a busy signal, Kim may have decided to hitch a ride with someone else who did her harm. On January the 5th, 2 days after she was last seen, Kim's body was found pinned against a bridge in a drainage ditch on County Road 65 in a remote area of Brazoria County, located 22 miles from the high school. It was determined that Kim had been strangled to death with a ligature, possibly a rope, and even though her body was partially nude, there were no signs of sexual assault. One detail from the crime that Bell accurately described in his confession letters was that Kim had been wearing a black fur coat when she went missing, and this coat was found hanging on a nearby fence at the murder scene. It was reported that a red Volkswagen had been circling the area around J. Frank Dobie High School during the time period Kim went missing, and while we can't be certain if she actually climbed into it, this may prove to be a key detail. While Bell was driving a white van during the previous years, it sounds like by 1973 he had started driving a red Volkswagen, which he rented from a dealership that he worked at. This is confirmed by police records from another incident Bell was involved with 1 year later. In April of 1974, a man showed up at the front door of a 14-year-old girl named Vicky Reinagle, who lived in the town of Baycliff and had a friend over at her residence that day. The man told Vicky and her friend that a guy across the street had caught a large fish they needed to see, so he convinced the two girls to follow him over there. But once they arrived, the man dropped his pants and started exposing himself, so Vicky and her friend immediately ran away. The man soon fled the scene in a red Volkswagen, but one of Vicky's neighbors caught the license plate number and reported it to the police, and sure enough, it was traced to Edward Harold Bell. I mentioned in my previous episode that Bell was arrested no less than 7 times for such offenses as exposing himself and masturbating in front of children, but he never had to do any jail time for this and would receive court-ordered sex offender treatment. It sounds like the exact same thing happened here, as Vicky and her friend were never asked to identify Bell as the man who flashed them, and the case never went to court. But it was just 5 months after this incident when 2 more young girls went missing from a town located only 6 miles away from Baycliff. So in addition to Debbie Ackerman and Maria Johnson, Bell claimed that he killed 2 other unnamed pairs of girls who were traveling together, one of whom hailed from Webster, and of course, that would probably be Rhonda Renee Johnson and Sharon Shaw. He said that the other pair of girls were from the town of Dickinson, which is located in Galveston County, nearly halfway between Galveston and Houston. In all likelihood, he was referring to 12-year-old Brooks Bracewell and 14-year-old Georgia Gear, a pair of best friends who vanished on September the 6th, 1974. That morning, the two girls left home in order to attend school, but ditched their books and school bags in a nearby wooded area and decided to spend the day skipping class together. Later that afternoon, Brooks's older sister, Sherry Bracewell, bumped into the two girls inside a bar at the El Rancho Motel, a popular spot where a lot of the local kids liked to hang out to play pool and pinball. Sherry had a ride with some other friends of hers, and when they decided to leave, Brooks and Georgia asked if they could get a ride. But since their car was already full, Sherry told the two girls that they would need to find their own way home. After Sherry and her friends left, Georgia was last seen sticking her thumb out to hitch a ride, but her and Brooks were never seen alive again. When the two girls failed to resurface, their families attempted to report them missing, but since Dickinson didn't have its own police department, the case would be handled by the Galveston County Sheriff's Office. And unfortunately, they pretty much wrote off the girls as runaways, so their families had to conduct their own searches and hang up missing persons posters. On April the 18th, 1976, a pair of skulls and some other skeletal remains were discovered in an oil field near Alvin, just under 12 miles away from Dickinson. The condition of the skull seemed to indicate that the victim suffered blows to the head, but the medical examiner said he did not have enough evidence to identify them, and initially believed that the remains belonged to two females and a male. Since they had technically been discovered in Brazoria County rather than Galveston County, it seems like no one put two and two together for the next 5 years and figured out that these victims might be Brooks and Georgia. And interestingly enough, if you look at newspaper coverage from that time period, there was speculation that the remains might have belonged to Mary Rachel Trelisa, Lisa Renee Wilson, and Julianne Mosley, aka the Fort Worth Three, who vanished from a Fort Worth shopping center in December of 1974, but this possibility was ruled out. Finally, in April of 1981, after a new detective took over the Brazoria County Sheriff's Office investigation, they decided to perform a new search of the oil field, where they would uncover additional skeletal remains, as well as clothing fragments which seemed to match the description of what Brooks and Georgia were last seen wearing. Dental records soon positively identified the two girls as the victims. Now, even though Bell and his wife had been living in an apartment in Galveston in 1971, they eventually moved into a trailer which was nicknamed the Caboose because it was painted red and looked like one. By 1974, Bell had moved the Caboose onto a fenced-in rural lot in the unincorporated community of Altaloma, and this spot was 3 miles away from the El Rancho Motel, where Brooks and Georgia had last been seen alive. The Caboose was also only about 200 yards from Humble Camp Road, which led to the bridge where Debbie Ackerman and Maria Johnson's bodies were found in Turner Bayou, 2 miles away. Other than the fact that he was living in the area at the time, there really isn't anything to definitively link Bell to the murders of Brooks and Georgia, but let's talk about the two remaining victims, who may be among the 11 who went to heaven. Again, Bell never mentioned either of these two girls' names, but investigators believe he may have been referring to them because they were murdered in this region of Texas during the 1970s, and their cases are still unsolved. One of the victims was Brenda Jones, a 14-year-old African-American girl from Galveston who went to visit her aunt at Jenny Seeley Hospital on the afternoon of July the 11th, 1971. After Brenda left the hospital, a bus driver recalled giving her a ride and dropping her off a few blocks from her residence. The driver advised Brenda to walk home quickly because it was about to get dark, but Brenda said she was going to grab a Coke for her sister. Well, Brenda never made it home, and the following morning, her body was found floating in Galveston Bay near the Pelican Island Bridge. She was nude from the waist down and had her underwear stuffed inside her mouth, and her wrists and ankles were bound with plastic laces from a pair of Roman sandals she had been wearing. Due to the lack of rigor mortis, it was estimated that Brenda had been dead only a few hours before she was found, so she may have been kept alive for a while after she vanished. Due to the bruising on her neck, the medical examiner theorized that her cause of death was manual strangulation. Now, during the filming of the 11 TV series, a box of evidence from Brenda's case, which had been kept in storage for decades, was uncovered, and it contained the plastic laces from her sandals. New testing revealed that there was a quantity of male DNA on the laces, but unfortunately, it wasn't large enough to create a full DNA profile. Well, even though Bell had no direct connection to Brenda, he did have a connection to Jenny Seeley Hospital, because after he was arrested for exposing himself to a child in 1969, he was ordered to seek psychiatric sex offender treatment at this hospital. His inpatient treatment lasted 10 months, and Bell wound up meeting his second wife there. Even though Brenda's murder took place in July of 1971, Bell did continue visiting the hospital for outpatient therapy, and he would also be accused of committing another horrific crime there. On November the 21st, 1974, a woman named Susan Witten, who was being hospitalized at Jenny Seeley for depression, wound up being abducted from the parking lot at gunpoint by a man who forced her into his truck and proceeded to gag her and tie her up. The man took Susan to a remote construction site to rape her, though he did not take off all of her clothes, and instead raised her dress and removed her underwear in order to penetrate her. He also told Susan that he kidnapped and raped women at least once or twice per week. The man did let Susan go, but 4 days later, he reappeared and approached her at a Holiday Inn where she was staying. This time, he was arrested by the police before he could do any further harm, and he was identified as Edward Harold Bell. While Bell was charged with aggravated rape, and the case was brought in front of a grand jury, they ruled that there was insufficient evidence to prosecute. Bell actually claimed that Susan was his girlfriend, and the sex they had was consensual, and for whatever reason, they believed him. So our last possible victim was 12-year-old Suzanne Bowers, who went by the name Susie. In 1977, Susie was living in Galveston and spent a lot of time staying at her grandparents' house. At around 10:40 a.m. on the morning of May the 21st, Susie left there in order to walk back home to grab a bathing suit as she was planning to head to the beach. Susie had asked her grandfather for a ride, but in a tragic turn of events, he told her that the exercise from walking would be good for her. Well, even though the walk was only 2.5 blocks, Susie never made it back home and did not show up at the beach. Once again, when her family attempted to report her missing, the police were inclined to believe that she simply ran away and there was little investigating for the next 2 years. On March the 25th, 1979, Susie's skeletal remains were discovered behind a cattle pen in a remote area of Altaloma. Even though she had a skull fracture and there were holes in it, the medical examiner could not determine her exact cause of death and was uncertain if the holes were gunshots or had been caused by animal activity. Susie's case made the news in 1984 when convicted serial killer Henry Lee Lucas confessed to her murder. The authorities were initially inclined to believe him, as Lucas apparently gave details about the crime that only the perpetrator could have known, and was able to lead investigators to the spot where her remains were found. But Lucas was never charged with Susie's murder, as there was no conclusive evidence to implicate him, and as I'm sure you're well aware, Lucas was notorious for falsely confessing to hundreds of murders he did not commit. Years later, one of Susie's childhood friends, Sarah Groves, wrote to Lucas in prison to ask if he killed her, but he wrote back and denied it, claiming that he falsely confessed to Susie's murder in order to get extra perks from the authorities, such as cigarettes and access to a television. According to Sarah, an informant once told Susie's grandmother that he was present when Susie's murder took place and witnessed another man kill her, though no further details about this have ever been released. But a man who leased the land where Susie's remains were found recalled seeing a van and a pickup truck on the property around the time of her disappearance. Sarah also wrote Edward Harold Bell in prison to ask him if he murdered Susie, and he responded by saying that he did not remember ever hearing about her case. But as you might recall, during that time period, Bell was living in a trailer known as the Caboose, which was parked in a remote area of Altaloma, just over 2 miles away from where Susie's remains were found. Bell also owned a tugboat which ran supplies to oil rigs, and the tugboat's captain just happened to live right behind Susie's grandparents' house. Bell often visited the captain in his residence, so he easily could have seen Susie at some point and decided to target her. It's also worth noting that in one episode of the 11 TV series, Lisa Olson and Fred Page documented themselves traveling to Panama City, where Bell had lived as a fugitive for several years until he was arrested in 1993. They wanted to explore the possibility that Bell could have been responsible for additional murders while he was down there during that time period. Olson and Page managed to track down and speak with Bell's third wife, Bernardina Ramirez, who denied having knowledge of any crimes he might have committed in Panama, but sent out a public plea for him to make a full confession to everything he had done. A Panamanian police investigator also agreed to be interviewed and said that Bell was considered a potential suspect in two unsolved disappearances involving young women. One of the victims was a nursing student who went missing after getting on a bus to the town of Chepo, where Bell initially lived when he first arrived in Panama. The other victim was a practicing nurse who vanished in fairly close proximity to the Pedro Miguel Boat Club in Panama City, where Bell had been residing at the time he was arrested. But unfortunately, there were no specific details available on these two victims or their cases, as a lot of the original police records from that time period went missing after Operation Just Cause, where the United States invaded Panama during late 1989 and early 1990 and arrested deposed dictator Manuel Noriega. So to recap, the 11 victims who are believed to be the 11 who went to heaven are Debbie Ackerman, Maria Johnson, Rhonda Renee Johnson, Sharon Shaw, Colette Wilson, Gloria Gonzalez, Brooks Bracewell, Georgia Gear, Brenda Jones, Kimberly Pitchford, and Suzanne Bowers. However, even when Bell confessed to these murders, he did not take full responsibility for them, as he always claimed that his urges to kill, rape, and expose himself were caused by him being forced into a so-called brainwashing program called the Program. Bell has explained the program in great detail during interviews, and the whole thing is so nonsensical that I'm not going to waste much time talking about it. But long story short, Bell says his father first forced him into the program when he was only 3 years old, and it involved many people he knew throughout the course of his life, including his three ex-wives, his scoutmasters, and a cousin. Since the program did not work like it was supposed to, Bell said his father attempted to hire a hitman to kill him when he was 15 years old, and he even once tried to brainwash him into killing himself. Bell maintained that if he was ever charged with any additional murders and brought into a courtroom, he would plead not guilty and blame his actions on the program. In fact, Bell would even blame the murder of Larry Dickens on the program, though he later changed his story and claimed that the police actually killed Larry in order to frame him. When Lisa Olson interviewed Bell for her Houston Chronicle article in 2011, he told her that he would only provide evidence to corroborate his confessions to the 11 Who Went to Heaven murders if he was granted immunity from any further prosecution for these crimes. Naturally, law enforcement, as well as the family members of these victims, have always had divided opinions about whether Bell's confessions were genuine. Some of them thought he was nothing more than an attention seeker, as one investigator expressed their belief that Bell was running a quote-unquote Lucas scam in reference to Henry Lee Lucas and his desire to attain notoriety by falsely confessing to crimes. But Sharon Shaw's aunt, Dottie Walker, a longtime advocate for victims of crime, has stated that even though she always used to be certain that Michael Lloyd Self murdered her niece, Bell's confessions left her feeling unsure that Self was the right guy. Well, in 2017, Bell agreed to do on-camera interviews with Lisa Olson for The 11, but the whole thing turned out to be an exercise in frustration, since Bell completely recanted his confessions and now denied killing anyone. He claimed that he had falsely confessed to a bunch of other murders because he was feeling suicidal at the time and was hoping that it would lead to him receiving the death penalty. Of course, Bell's recantation may have had something to do with the fact that he was eligible for parole shortly after The 11 aired, but not surprisingly, he wound up being denied. Regardless, the Galveston County District Attorney's Office still believed that Bell's confessions to the murders of Debbie Ackerman and Maria Johnson were compelling enough to reopen the investigation, and they publicly named Bell as the prime suspect. On April the 20th, 2019, Bell died in prison of heart failure at the age of 79, and at the time of this recording, he has never been conclusively linked to any murders besides the killing of Larry Dickens. Officially, the law still recognizes Michael Lloyd Self as the killer of Rhonda Renee Johnson and Sharon Shaw, and these other nine murders which took place in Texas during the 1970s are still considered to be unsolved. So after five decades, there are no conclusive answers about the 11 who went to heaven. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. So putting this series together has been quite a challenge, because even though I've previously done episodes in which I've covered multiple cold cases at the same time, I've never had to tackle 11 of them before. Technically, all these murders took place during one six-year period within a radius of approximately 50 square miles, and even though two of these crimes are technically considered to be solved, it's pretty chilling that most of them are not. And until Edward Harold Bell decided to make his confessions from behind bars, there was not even a solid suspect in many of these cases. One of the most shocking things about this story from today's perspective is just how young most of these victims were and how freely they were traveling around. With the exception of Gloria Gonzalez, these girls were between the ages of 12 and 16, yet many of them were using hitchhiking as their primary form of transportation and were likely murdered after getting a ride with the wrong person. Hell, Brooks Bracewell and Georgia Gear, who were only 12 and 14 years old respectively, had spent the afternoon hanging out at a bar with other teenagers and were last seen alive while sticking out their thumb to hitch a ride. The aforementioned book, Deliver Us, contained quotes from Rhonda Renee Johnson and Sharon Shaw's childhood friend, Glenda Willis, and she pretty much summed up the situation perfectly when she stated, quote, "It was a different time. We were young and felt like nothing could hurt us. Looking back, of course, it was foolish. I mean, we weren't afraid of anything. We never thought anyone was truly evil. I guess that wasn't a good thing, but we just didn't know." End quote. Indeed, it's probably because of tragedies like these that the next generation of kids learn to be more cautious. Of course, the big unanswered question is whether or not all 11 of these victims were murdered by the same serial killer, and if that person was Edward Harold Bell. I'm sure most Unsolved Mysteries fans would rank Bell as one of the most reprehensible criminals ever profiled on the show, but when the episode about him first aired 30 years ago, I don't think anyone suspected that he may have been a prolific serial killer. Sure, there was no doubt that he was an habitual sex offender, but the only murder he was tied to was Larry Dickens, which was not a pre-planned crime either, as Larry only wound up being killed because he tried to prevent Bell from escaping before the police could arrest him for exposing himself to children. If Bell was actually responsible for killing 11 girls, then it's ironic that he wound up being caught for the murder of an adult male victim. Of course, one of the main reasons the Unsolved Mysteries segment about Bell is so memorable is because a then-unknown Matthew McConaughey portrayed Larry Dickens during the reenactments. The show often liked to film their segments at the original locations where the stories took place and would cast local, non-professional actors. And since McConaughey just happened to be living in Texas at that time and was looking to launch an acting career, he wound up getting this part. But the segment as a whole is one of the most well-acted, well-produced, and frightening segments that Unsolved Mysteries ever filmed, as it truly makes you feel the pure terror that Larry and his family must have experienced that day. One disturbing detail that the segment does not mention is that Larry's 3-year-old daughter, Wendy, just happened to be present at the house when her father's murder took place, but I'm sure that only made Larry extra motivated to take Bell's keys to prevent him from escaping. If Bell truly was a serial killer, then Larry's actions seem even more heroic in retrospect, because he may have inadvertently saved additional lives. Had Bell not been arrested and forced to flee the country, could he have gone on to murder additional victims in Texas? After seeing how he was portrayed on Unsolved Mysteries, I didn't think it was possible to feel any more disgust towards Edward Harold Bell, but then I watched his interviews with Lisa Olson on The 11. Following his incarceration, Bell blamed all of his crimes on this so-called program of his, maintaining that he was brainwashed into doing everything that he did, and up until the day he died, it sounds like Bell took zero responsibility for his actions. The way Bell described it, the program was this elaborate conspiracy which involved hundreds, perhaps thousands of people, and existed for the sole purpose of forcing him to commit murders and sexual offenses. While it's certainly possible that Bell started suffering from serious mental illness as he got older, when I see him talk about this nonsense involving the program in his interviews, it all comes across as an act to me. It's almost like he's using this whole thing as an excuse to keep himself in the spotlight without actually having to admit that he did anything wrong. Even though Bell wrote letters confessing to no less than 11 murders, he eventually recanted all his confessions and claimed that the whole 11 went to heaven business was nothing but lies, and he never actually killed anybody in his life. But of course, Bell made his recantations right around the time he was about to have a parole hearing, and even though the chances of him walking out of prison were slim to none, I'm sure he didn't want to jeopardize that by implicating himself in other murders. The fact of the matter is that convicted murderers, Henry Lee Lucas being one of the most infamous examples, do this sort of stuff all the time, where they'll falsely confess to crimes they did not commit, or refuse to admit culpability for other crimes they did commit. And of course, since they're very narcissistic individuals, they will get off on toying with people and constantly changing their stories. When Bell sent out his initial confession letters, he had already been in prison for 5 years for Larry Dickens' murder, and was possibly yearning for attention again. I will say that as vile a human being as Bell may be, he is still something of an enigma, because for the first 30 years of his life, he seemed like an ordinary person who was a university graduate, had a wife and three children, and a pretty successful business career. His first arrest for exposing himself to a child took place in 1969, and I'd be curious to know if he had any prior history of offenses like this, or if he just suddenly started doing them at age 30. It's pretty ridiculous that Bell never had to do any jail time for these offenses, even though he was arrested 7 times in 9 years, and I have no idea how he was able to get bond for the murder of Larry Dickens. Bell always bragged that he was able to talk himself out of anything, and everyone who knew him said he was a pretty effective con artist, which might explain why he was able to remain a pretty successful businessman who made himself a decent amount of money, even though he kept getting arrested for sexual offenses against children. But watching Bell's interviews with Lisa Olson, even though he spends a lot of time spouting nonsense about the program, he still comes across as a friendly, pleasant guy during his regular interactions with her, so you can understand how he would have been able to manipulate people. In other words, he definitely comes across as someone who could convince unsuspecting teenage girls to accept a ride with him before he harmed them. So before we talk about the 11 who went to heaven victims, I should mention that they were only the tip of the iceberg in a widespread problem which plagued that region of Texas for decades. I'm sure many of you have probably heard of the Texas killing fields, a term which has been used to describe an area situated alongside Interstate 45, just southeast of Houston, where over 30 young female victims have been found murdered since the early 1970s. In fact, a documentary series about the topic titled Crime Scene, The Texas Killing Fields was just released on Netflix 3 months ago. While the 11 who went to heaven victims were briefly mentioned, the series mostly focused on murders which took place in the killing fields during the 1980s and 90s, some of which have been solved. While the Texas killing fields would definitely be an interesting topic for an entire podcast series, these episodes are going to focus exclusively on the murders which took place during the 1970s. We know that Edward Harold Bell could not be responsible for any of the crimes which occurred after 1978, because he was either out of the country or in prison, but I do find it interesting that the murders in the killing fields just seemed to come to a halt for a few years after Bell went on the run as a wanted fugitive. The fact of the matter is that even though there is no conclusive evidence linking Bell to any of the murders which took place during the 1970s, he definitely would have had the opportunity, as he lived in the same area, and his job as a traveling salesman meant that he spent a lot of time commuting on Interstate 45. However, I should mention that there were a couple other murders of female victims which took place in this region during the 1970s, which did wind up getting solved. If you search online for information about the Texas killing fields, you'll often find 12-year-old Allison Craven on the list of victims, as she was abducted from her apartment complex in Houston on November the 9th, 1971, before her remains were found scattered in 2 separate fields just over 2 months later. But this one was resolved relatively quickly, as one of Allison's neighbors, Henry Doyle Shufflin Jr., was charged and convicted of a murder and received a 25-year prison sentence, and I see no indication that Shuffling was ever considered a suspect in any of the other murders. Only a few days before Allison was killed, another murder took place in Houston's Pearland suburb when a 21-year-old barmaid named Linda Faye Sutherland went missing during the early morning hours of November the 4th. 3 days later, her body was found lying in some weeds near a bridge along County Road 89 in Brazoria County, 40 miles outside of Houston. Linda Faye had been beaten and shot to death, and even though she was still clothed, she had been sexually assaulted, and one of the legs from her pantyhose was tied around her hands, while the second leg was wrapped around her neck. In April of 1972, a 24-year-old tow truck driver named Harry Lanham and an accomplice named Anthony Napa were both charged with Linda Faye's murder, as they had picked her up in Lanham's tow truck after she pulled over due to car trouble. In October of that year, Lanham and Napa went on trial and were each convicted of the crime by separate juries, with Napa receiving a sentence of 50 years, while Lanham received 25 years. While he was in the Harris County Jail awaiting transport to the prison, Lanham supposedly made claims that he had murdered a number of girls from Galveston, and while he was extensively interviewed about this by the authorities, no charges were ever filed. Colette Wilson's father, Tom Wilson, actually made arrangements to speak with Lanham in jail and asked him if he murdered his daughter, but while I'm not sure if Lanham officially denied it, Tom came away believing that Lanham was not the killer. On December the 30th, Lanham was shot and killed during a botched jail escape, and Anthony Napa only served about one-third of his prison sentence before he was paroled in 1989. Other than those incriminating comments Lanham was alleged to have made in jail, there does not seem to be anything that conclusively links either of these men to the 11 who went to heaven, and at 21 years of age, Linda Faye Sutherland was slightly older than the other victims. Now, getting back to Edward Harold Bell, it's obviously going to be very difficult to link him to any of these murders after all these years, especially since he's passed away. In recent years, genetic genealogy and DNA profiling have made it possible to conclusively solve cold cases which took place many years ago, even if the perpetrator is already dead. Since Bell was a convicted murderer, his DNA is definitely in the system, but the problem is that there is no DNA evidence from these crimes to compare it to. Obviously, back in the 1970s, no one was thinking about carefully preserving evidence for the purposes of DNA testing, but it's still incredibly frustrating that so much evidence has gone missing, and there is no available DNA profile for the killer. The closest thing investigators have is the plastic laces from Brenda Jones' sandals, but even though they do have traces of male DNA, it's not enough for a full profile. Since the box containing those laces were kept in a storage room and forgotten about for several decades, I guess we can always hope that additional evidence from these crimes containing DNA might be filed away somewhere collecting dust, waiting to be discovered. Obviously, you cannot close any of these cases based solely on Bell's confessions, as he's not exactly a reliable source, which is why cold case investigators have diligently searched for any sort of corroborating evidence which could function as a smoking gun. Now obviously, if Bell had shared any exclusive details about the murders in his confession letters, which were not already public knowledge, then this would be pretty damning, but he never did this. However, even though Bell shared some details about these crimes which were not accurate, a surprising number of them were. This would mostly apply to the Debbie Ackerman, Maria Johnson, Colette Wilson, and Kimberly Pitchford murders, since these were the victims he specifically referred to by name. As an example, Bell mentioned that Kim wore a black fur coat at the time she was last seen, and he correctly recalled that Colette was wearing a Mickey Mouse t-shirt and purple-colored shorts on the day she went missing. Bell even threw in additional details which were not shared publicly, such as Maria having a $20 bill inside her purse, but since those particular details were also not mentioned in the original case file, no one can be certain if they're actually true. But the fact of the matter is that if Bell is lying about his involvement in these murders, that he must have a pretty strong memory to accurately recall such specific details decades after the fact. Yes, since Bell lived in that area of Texas during the 1970s, I'm sure he would have read about the crimes in the newspapers, but his initial confession letters were not sent out until 1998, and it's not like he could just go back and double-check the details on the internet or dig through newspaper archives in prison. It's also worth noting that when Fred Page searched through the news archives, he could not find one single article which happened to contain every single detail about the crimes shared in Bell's confession letters. So once again, if this was a hoax, it would have required Bell to somehow obtain information from multiple sources. So we're going to start off by discussing the murders of Rhonda Renee Johnson and Sharon Shaw, as it's obviously the most controversial of these cases, due to the questionable conviction of Michael Lloyd Self. I devoted our entire previous episode to this case, so if you haven't listened to it yet, I'd recommend going back to learn all the full details. To recap, the Unsolved Mystery segment on Edward Harold Bell aired on December the 2nd, 1992, while their final appeal segment on Michael Lloyd Self's conviction aired 5.5 months later on May the 19th, 1993. At the time, I don't think anyone had any inkling that these two stories might be connected, but if Self was innocent and Bell was the real killer, then the whole situation is a pretty astonishing coincidence. Bell's initial confession letters were sent out 2 years before Self died behind bars, but his defense attorneys claim they never found out about the letters until after Self passed away. At the time of his death, Self had appealed his conviction all the way to the United States Supreme Court, who declined to hear his case, so he was pretty much out of legal options. But if Self's attorneys had gotten the opportunity to learn about Bell's confessions while their client was still alive, who knows if things might have turned out differently. While there is compelling circumstantial evidence to link Bell to some of the other crimes we've discussed, there really isn't much to connect him with Renee and Sharon's murders. All we have is Bell claiming that he cared a pair of unnamed girls from Webster, and at the time, he happened to be living in Galveston, in fairly close proximity to the location where the girls were last seen alive. But even if Bell did not actually kill these two victims, that doesn't necessarily mean that Self did. On the surface, this case has all the hallmarks of a wrongful conviction narrative. We have a man of below average intelligence who is charged with murder on the basis of a confession which he claims was coerced, and there is very little corroborating evidence. And within a few years, two of the cops who arrested Self and obtained his confession wind up going to prison for bank robbery, making it easier to believe they were capable of pinning this crime on an innocent man. It's not hard to imagine why Self was found guilty of this crime, because back in the early 1970s, the general public had far less knowledge about false confessions, so I'm sure the jury at his trial had a hard time believing that he would have confessed to something he didn't actually do. I do think that only charging Self with Sharon's murder and not Renee's murder was a pretty sneaky tactic to get around potential double jeopardy issues, as this meant they had the option to bring Self to trial again if he was found not guilty the first time around. This same process was used in another controversial case from Texas, and that's the conviction of Darlie Routier for the 1996 murders of her young sons, Damon and Devin, as she was technically only put on trial and found guilty of Damon's murder, but could have conceivably been taken to trial again for Devin's murder if she had been acquitted. Obviously, since Self is deceased, and we don't have any DNA evidence available in this case, it will be very difficult to clear Self's name and grant him a posthumous exoneration, barring the possibility that another suspect is somehow implicated in this crime. One thing which could support Self's innocence is that he was questioned about some of the other murders of teenage girls which took place during this time period, such as Debbie Ackerman, Maria Johnson, and Colette Wilson, and it does not sound like investigators believe that Self was responsible for these crimes. And while Self was incarcerated, more teenage girls from the area, such as Kimberly Pitchford, Brooks Bracewell, and Georgia Gear, wound up getting murdered. It might seem like too much of a coincidence that Self could be responsible for the murders of Renee and Sharon while a completely different serial killer was operating in the area at the same time. But on the other hand, the murders of Allison Craven and Linda Faye Sutherland also occurred during this time period, and they were likely unrelated to the 11 who went to heaven. But for the moment, let's dismiss all these other crimes and objectively look at the case for Self's guilt or innocence in the murders of Renee and Sharon. It is true that some of the girls' friends and relatives have openly expressed their doubt that Self was the right guy. Even Doug O'Brien, the prosecutor who represented the state during Self's appeals, came to believe that Self was innocent, and that sort of thing is incredibly rare. However, in spite of Don Morris's obvious character issues, there is the possibility that the claims about him beating Self with a nightstick and playing a game of Russian roulette to extract a false confession might be greatly exaggerated. Self's account of this event is inconsistent, as he initially said that there were two other police officers in the interrogation room while this took place, and then later claimed that Morris was alone. We technically don't have any other eyewitnesses who personally witnessed Self being beaten or threatened with a gun, but there are witnesses who claim that Self never mentioned anything about police brutality after he was charged with murder, and there were no signs of physical abuse on his body. Nude photographs were taken of Self following his arrest and showcased on screen during the 11 TV series, and yes, they do not appear to show any noticeable bruises or marks on him. Now, Self's original defense attorney, Dewey Meadows, would later acknowledge that during their first meeting together, he never saw any bruises on Self's body. But he did claim that Self rolled up his shirt to display a rend area on his abdomen, where he said Morris jabbed him with a nightstick, though Meadows says this could have been caused from Self wearing a tight belt. Since the nude photos of Self are black and white and very grainy quality, it is difficult to discern if Self could have had this reddened area on his abdomen. However, it's worth noting that Meadows only shared this story about Self's abdomen when he testified at a post-conviction habeas hearing in 1990, but never mentioned it while testifying at a suppression hearing, which took place years earlier. So it is possible that Meadows decided to add in this detail after the fact in order to lend more credence to the police brutality claims. But still, even if Morris never committed physical abuse, which left noticeable marks on Self's body, that doesn't mean he couldn't have threatened him into making a false confession. One of the biggest advocates for Self's innocence was Dave Coburn, who was the original lead investigator on the case, but resigned from the Webster PD when Morris was appointed the new police chief, replacing Coburn's friend, J.C. Norman. Coburn claimed that he had personally witnessed Morris do the whole Russian roulette routine on another prisoner 1 year before the incident with Self, which could have been a potentially explosive revelation if he had testified at Self's trial. But it sounds like Coburn would not have been a very credible witness, since he apparently had his own issues with police brutality and mistreating prisoners. One issue with Coburn's story is that if you look at the timeline, this incident would have taken place while Coburn was working for the Webster PD, and Morris was still working for the Traffic Division of the Texas Department of Public Safety. So why would these officers from two different law enforcement agencies be present in the same room for the interrogation of a prisoner? It would not surprise me if Coburn fabricated the story because he was bitter about Morris and Tommy Deal swooping into his department, forcing him and his former boss out, and then quickly solving a murder case that Coburn had been unable to crack within the past several months. Coburn's credibility is an important point to consider, because he seems to be the sole source of one of the biggest pieces of evidence which might support Self's innocence. Coburn says that he obtained sworn statements from two girls who claimed they spoke to Renee and Sharon in Galveston between 8 and 9 p.m. on the night they went missing, even though Self confessed that he picked them up at around 9 o'clock in Webster, which is 25 miles away from Galveston. But then again, even if Coburn is telling the truth about this, it's also possible those two girls might be mistaken and actually interacted with Renee and Sharon in Galveston on a completely different night. So obviously, Self's first confession when he was charged with murder had some major holes, such as him claiming that he picked up Sharon at her house, even though her family maintained that she never came home at all that night. If you believe Self was railroaded, then this gives off the impression that law enforcement was well aware of how problematic the confession was, which is why they made Self sign a second written confession 3 days later, which cleared up some of the discrepancies in his story. One of the reasons the courts kept turning down Self's appeals is because he gave this confession after being read his rights, and he never asked for his attorney, even though he was supposedly given the opportunity, and Dewey Meadows told Self not to speak to the police without him. And Don Morris, whom Self said he was afraid of when he made his first confession, was not even present when he made the second one. In the court's eyes, Self gave this additional confession of his own free will, which is why they did not believe he was coerced. But Self was an easily suggestible person with below-average intelligence, and there are numerous examples of people like that making false confessions which led to wrongful convictions. If all we had were these two confessions, then I'd have no trouble believing that Self was railroaded, but the big sticking point for me is this so-called third confession slash road trip, where two deputies checked Self out of the county jail and had him direct them to all the locations he visited when he picked up the two girls, murdered them, and disposed of their bodies. Self's supporters will claim that he either already knew about these locations from the media coverage, or they were fed to him by law enforcement, and I might be more inclined to believe the second scenario if Morris or Deal or someone from the Webster PD had signed Self out of the jail and taken him on this tour. But the whole thing was done by two deputies from the Harris County Sheriff's Office, a completely different law enforcement agency. The 11 series features an interview with Hank Bamer, one of the deputies who did this, and he continued to maintain that when he visited Self in jail, Self confessed to the murders without provocation, and agreed to direct him to all of the locations associated with the crime. Boehmer claimed that he had limited knowledge of the case and did not feed Self any information. Also, if you search online, you'll also find a copy of the original decision from the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit when they ruled to upheld Self's confession in September of 1992. They claimed that on June the 9th, 1972, almost immediately after he was charged with the murders, Self directed the police to the exact location where the girl's remains had been found. This would have been 2 weeks before his road trip with Boehmer, but the appeal doesn't specify if Self actually traveled to this location with police on June the 9th, or if he just told them where it was. The 11 also featured an interview with George Kelt, the federal magistrate who ruled that Self's conviction should be overturned in 1990. Kelt said he did not put too much credence into Self having led the authorities to that spot, because the case had been such a huge news story in Webster back in 1972. The location where the girl's remains were found was published in all the local newspapers, so this is where Self could have learned this information. Kelt even equated the situation to charging someone with a JFK assassination because they managed to lead the authorities to the Texas School Book Depository. While the flaw in Kelt's analogy is that the Texas School Book Depository is a very distinct building in the middle of a city, whereas the location where the girl's remains were found was a remote, desolate bayou in the middle of nowhere. I actually delved into the newspaper archives and looked up some of the original articles about the discovery of the remains, and they don't appear to be very specific with details about the location, only that they were found in a field or a marsh or a drainage ditch near Taylor Bayou. So would Self have been able to lead the authorities to the correct spot if he did not have inside knowledge? I do have to concede that even if the newspapers did not publish specific details, there was a 4-month gap between the discovery of the remains and Self's arrest, and I would not be surprised if word might have spread throughout the community about the exact spot where these remains were found. And Self also happened to be friends with the previous police chief, J.C. Norman, and liked to hang out and chat with some of the local police officers about cases. It's not impossible that one of them could have told Self the exact location of the remains during casual conversation. However, it's worth noting that the aforementioned legal appeal states that when Self testified and was asked how he was able to pinpoint the exact spot where the remains were found, he never attempted to infer that anyone fed him with this information. His response was that he was, quote-unquote, just guessing. I don't know. This whole detail about Self leading the authorities to the location still bothers me and prevents me from being 100% convinced he was an innocent man. But there are also a number of troubling details which prevent me from being fully convinced he was guilty. Before Bell entered the picture, it seems like the biggest potential alternate suspect was Patrick Heffernan, who came forward and confessed to the murders in 1980. While his confession was vague and disjointed, and the authorities did not deem him to be credible, he did reveal a detail about the crime which was not public knowledge, and that was the presence of a black cord at the murder scene which was used to tie the girls down. Even though it's mentioned that Heffernan knew Renee and Sharon personally, there really isn't much information out there about him to judge his likelihood as a suspect, though the fact that he apparently had psychological problems could mean that he decided to fabricate his confession for his own reasons. His confession also did not take place until years after Self was convicted, and even though the detail about the cord was not published in the media, I guess it's possible that it may have leaked out since the case was technically closed and Heffernan just happened to hear it somewhere. But I have to say that I find it a bit troubling that Self never mentioned this black cord or tying up the girls during any of his confessions. His story just involves killing both girls in a fit of rage and haphazardly dumping their bodies into the bayou. Obviously, since Renee and Sharon were nothing but skeletal remains by the time they were found, we have no idea how exactly they were tied up. But we have three other victims, Brenda Jones, Debbie Ackerman, and Maria Johnson, who were murdered in 1971 and had their hands and feet bound together when their bodies were discovered, and that's a compelling similarity. I guess one of my biggest issues with this case is that in every version of his confession, Self claimed that he picked up Renee and Sharon and Webster at around 9 p.m. And if he's telling the truth, then we have a window of about 12 hours in which the girl's whereabouts are unaccounted for. As you might recall, Renee and Sharon made the 25-mile trip from Webster to Galveston by hitching a ride with a neighbor, but were told by Renee's father that they needed to be back home by 1 p.m. because he was going to phone them and make sure they were there. The last known person to see the girls alive was Glenda Willis, who bumped into them in Galveston sometime after 9 a.m. Renee and Sharon told her they would get a ride to Webster with someone else, but after they answered the phone call at Renee's house, they were going to hitch another ride back to Galveston. Glenda told them that if they returned to Galveston and needed another ride home, she would meet them in front of the flagship motel at 5:30 p.m., but of course they never showed up, and they did not return to Renee's residence to answer the phone call at 1 o'clock either. When you look at the timeline, it seems to make a lot more sense that after parting ways with Glenda at 9 a.m., Renee and Sharon crossed paths with someone in Galveston who did them harm, and one of the reasons Edward Harold Bell seems to be a compelling suspect is because he was living there at the time. As far as I can tell, no one ever came forward to confirm having given the girls a ride back to Webster, even though Self claimed he crossed paths with them there at 9 p.m. Also, in Self's second confession, he said that he picked up Renee walking down the road alone, and they drove to the Nassau Bay Yacht Club to pick up Sharon. No explanation has ever been offered for why the two girls separated or what Sharon was doing at this yacht club to begin with. To be fair, Self did say that the girls told him they were going to get in trouble for not returning home when they were supposed to, and were attempting to cook up a story to explain why they were so late. So this could provide a potential explanation for why they were hanging around the streets of Webster at that time of night. But it still bugs the hell out of me that we have no information about the girls' whereabouts during the 12-hour gap between 9 a.m. and 9 p.m. that day. After first watching the final appeal segment about this case on Unsolved Mysteries, I spent several years being convinced that Michael Lloyd Self was wrongly convicted, and it was only after reading some of the court documents that I began to think that perhaps he may have actually done this. However, I would definitely still say there was reasonable doubt, and that some corrupt law enforcement officers may have used unethical methods to secure a conviction on a guilty man. But in Self's defense, even though he was up for parole in 1995 and could have potentially walked out of prison if he admitted his guilt, he still refused to do so. I mean, a lot of guilty people in prison never admit to what they did, but at that point, Self was completely out of legal options to overturn his conviction since the Supreme Court had declined to hear his case. It might speak volumes that Self insisted on maintaining his innocence, even though it ensured that he would die in prison. I also cannot overlook that a bunch of other similar crimes, which Self was not responsible for, happened to take place in that region of Texas during the same time period and pointed to the involvement of a serial killer. So even if Michael Lloyd Self was guilty all along and justice was served in this case, that doesn't change the fact that we still have 9 other victims whose murders are still unsolved. Since Edward Harold Bell never offered any specific details about the murders of Renee and Sharon, it's possible that he read about them in the papers at the time and decided to falsely take credit for the crime decades after the fact. That could explain why he did not recall their names and only referred to them as a murdered pair of girls from Webster. But was Bell actually responsible for any of these crimes? Well, you have to remember that when Bell sent out his original confession letters in 1998, he claimed that he murdered 7 victims, and it was only when he was interviewed by Lisa Olson several years later when he upped the total to 11 victims. So this makes me wonder if perhaps Bell killed some of these girls, but then later decided to exaggerate his exact number of victims in order to achieve additional notoriety. Prior to Larry Dickens' murder, most of Bell's crimes involved him exposing himself and masturbating in front of children, but things took a more violent turn in November of 1974, when he allegedly abducted and raped Susan Witten and was charged with aggravated rape. I only use the word allegedly because Bell was never actually prosecuted or convicted of that crime, but I think it says a lot about how badly sexual assault survivors were treated during the 1970s that a man can rape a woman at gunpoint and tell the authorities it was consensual sex, and they pretty much say, "Oh, we believe you, we'll take your word for it." I have no doubt that Susan Witten is telling the truth, and this rape actually happened, But what complicated things is that the assault took place after all but one of the 11 who went to heaven victims were murdered. If Bell had already killed all these other girls by this point, why would he let Susan go? How come she wasn't murdered like all the others? If you've already committed all these other crimes, why leave behind a living witness who could identify you and cause potential problems with the authorities? This could lend credence to the idea that even though Bell was an awful sex offender, he never actually killed anyone until his encounter with Larry Dickens in 1978. But it's interesting how Susan specifically said that Bell never completely disrobed her and only pulled up her dress and removed her underwear to rape her, as some of the other victims, such as Brenda Jones, Debbie Ackerman, and Maria Johnson, were found nude from the waist down. But let's go through each of these murders in chronological order, one by one. Even though Colette Wilson technically went missing 2 weeks before Brenda Jones, I'll start off by discussing Brenda's case, because her body was found before any of the others. Even though this crime took place in July of 1971, it really didn't get any media attention at all until months later, when other girls started turning up dead, and law enforcement looked at possible connections between the cases. The only tentative link between Brenda and Bell is that she went missing after leaving the same hospital where Bell had received sex offender treatment, though he was no longer being treated there at that time. Now, the abduction of Susan Witten does seem to indicate that Bell would keep returning to the hospital in the years after his treatment ended, but it's important to note that Brenda did not actually go missing from there. She vanished after she boarded a bus which dropped her off a few blocks from her home, though this doesn't preclude the idea that if Bell saw Brenda at the hospital, he could have followed the bus until she climbed out. Bell never specifically mentioned anything about Brenda during his confessions, only that he killed a couple of unnamed girls during this time period, so investigators have pretty much classified her as one of the 11 who went to heaven through the process of elimination. But one thing which makes Brenda stand out is that she's the only African-American girl among these 11 victims, so if Bell really did kill her, I find it curious that he would not have made any mention of her race. As far as I know, Bell never specifically said anything about murdering a black girl. It's also worth noting that even though most of the other victims were discovered in remote areas, Brenda's body was found floating in Galveston Bay near the Pelican Island Bridge, which is pretty close to the city. These details could be an indicator that Brenda's murder was a completely separate crime which was unconnected to all the other cases, but let's not forget that Brenda, Debbie Ackerman, and Maria Johnson were all found nude from the waist down and had their hands and feet bound together, and these crimes took place only 4.5 months apart. This suggests that all three girls may have been murdered by the same killer, even if Bell was not actually the perpetrator. So moving on to Colette Wilson, other than the fact that Bell mentioned her name during his confession letters, there really isn't much evidence linking him to her murder. Colette went missing from a remote intersection about 30 miles from Galveston, and while most of these other crimes took place to the east of Interstate 45, this one occurred to the west and was a bit more out of the way, especially since Colette's remains would be found in an area that was around 40 miles away from the spot she went missing. Since Colette vanished during a very narrow window of time while she was alone waiting for her mother, you have to wonder if someone followed her from the band competition in Stafford, or if Colette just had the misfortune of being in the wrong place at the wrong time when a predator passed through the area. One detail which might point away from Bell was the sighting from Claire Wilson of a black car parked by the side of the road near the intersection when she arrived. Granted, we still don't know if this vehicle is connected to the crime, as Claire only saw a male in the driver's seat and a female in the back seat, but could not be certain it was Colette. But it's been established that Bell was driving a white van during this time period, and I'm not sure if he would have had access to a black car. Our next victim is Gloria Gonzalez, who went missing from Houston 4 months after Colette vanished, and since Bell never specifically mentioned her name or any distinctive details about her, there isn't anything to tie him to her murder either. Out of all these cases, this is the one with the least information to work with, as all we really know is that Gloria disappeared after leaving her apartment, and we really don't know much about her as a person. When The 11 was filmed, Lisa Olson and Fred Page managed to get interviews with friends or family members of nearly all the victims who managed to shed additional light on the cases. But the one exception was Gloria Gonzalez, as her family declined to speak with them. It is true that Gloria is a bit different than the other victims, as she was Hispanic, whereas all the others besides Brenda Jones were white. And at 19 years of age, she was technically the only victim who was a legal adult. However, the main reason Gloria is believed to be one of the 11 who went to heaven is because her body just happened to be found in the same wooded area as Colette's remains, and they were only about 150 feet apart. Regardless of whether or not Belle was the perpetrator, I have to believe that Gloria and Colette were murdered by the same person, because if they were each killed by a different person who happened to dump their body so close together in that same remote area, it would be a truly astonishing coincidence. In fact, since they were found much further west than the other victims, perhaps Gloria and Colette's murders aren't related to the rest of these crimes. I mentioned earlier that Belle had business connections in the Houston neighborhood where Gloria lived, and he also apparently had some connections near the Attucks Reservoir, which is the same area these victims were found. So if I had to pick one of these cases where it seemed most likely that Belle was the perpetrator, it would be the murders of Debbie Ackerman and Maria Johnson. Not only did Belle mention their names and reveal specific details about the crime in his confession letters, but the two girls were last seen climbing into a white van, a vehicle which Belle drove at that time, and they were also known for being customers at a dive shop that Belle co-owned. It's also been established that Debbie and Maria had visited the lakefront house in Galveston where Belle had an apartment, so there would have been ample opportunities for them to meet Belle and for him to set his eyes on them. And of course, if the two girls personally knew Belle, they may have felt comfortable climbing into a van with him. It's unclear when exactly Belle decided to paint his van and get rid of it, but I can see him doing this if he felt that the description of the white van was garnering too much publicity in the area. Belle's description of how he shot Debbie and Maria does sound pretty vivid and convincing, as he specifically said they were shot in the head and the neck, and that his gun was pointed downward when he fired the shots, because the girls were in the water and he was standing on a bridge. I do find it unusual that out of all the victims, Debbie and Maria appeared to be the only ones who were shot to death, though I will add the disclaimer that Suzanne Bowers did have holes in her skull, though they were unable to determine if they were caused by gunshots or animal activity. So perhaps it's possible that Belle was responsible for this one crime, but not the others. It's also worth noting that judging from the estimated time of death, the medical examiner believed that Debbie and Maria, as well as Brenda Jones, had been alive for an extended period of time after they were last seen, which means they were possibly held in captivity. This scenario would make sense during the time period when Belle was living in the caboose in a rural area, but in 1971, he was still residing in his apartment at the waterfront house in Galveston, and it may have been difficult for him to hold someone captive without attracting attention, particularly since he was married at the time. While the 11 featured a recent interview with Bernardina Ramirez, Belle's wife during his time in Panama, we really don't know much about his second wife, whom he was living with in Texas during the 1970s. Her first name happened to be Debbie, which is the same name as one of the victims, and as far as I can tell, she has never publicly spoken about the situation. The circumstances of their marriage are pretty gross, since they first became involved when she was a 17-year-old psychiatric patient and he was 31, but I would be curious to know if she ever saw any red flags from her husband while she was living with him to suggest he may have been a serial killer. The only other victim that Belle named during his confessions was Kimberly Pitchford, whom he only referred to by her surname. Unlike some of the other victims here, Kim was described as being a rather shy girl who did not have a rebellious streak at all, so the most logical scenarios for her disappearance are that she was either forcibly abducted from her high school after she completed her driver's test, or she got a busy signal when she tried to phone her mother to come pick her up, and instead decided to accept a ride home from someone else who wound up harming her. We do have reports that a red Volkswagen, matching the description of a rented Volkswagen which Belle had been driving in that time, was seen in the area around the time of Kim's disappearance, but we really can't be certain if she actually climbed into that vehicle. Much like with Gloria Gonzalez's murder, this crime took place in Houston, which is not where Belle resided, though he often visited the city because he had an office there. And one detail that Belle got wrong in his confession is that he says he kidnapped Kim near the Gulfgate Mall, even though she was last seen at J. Frank Dobie High School, which is located about 7 miles away. But once again, Belle accurately remembered that Kim's black fur coat was found hanging on a fence near her body. This information was published in the newspapers at the time, so it's not an exclusive detail that only the perpetrator could have known, but it's pretty remarkable that Belle would still remember it 25 years after the fact if he had no personal connection to the crime. Moving on to the Georgia Gear and Brooks Bracewell murders, Belle never referred to them by name, but he did say that he killed a pair of girls from Dickinson, so investigators were pretty sure it had to be them. This would be the third pair of teenage girlfriends who were murdered while traveling together, so if Belle was responsible for all these crimes, perhaps he liked the challenge of killing two victims at once. We do know that Brooks and Georgia were last seen attempting to thumb a ride home from the bar at the El Rancho Motel, and Brooks's sister Sherry recalled there being about 2 or 3 adult males in the bar at the time they left, so it's easy to see how they could have gotten a ride from the wrong person. In 1974, Belle was living in the caboose only 3 miles away from the motel, so it's definitely not implausible that he could have been in the area on that day. Brooks and Georgia went missing only 5 months after the incident, where Belle exposed himself to Vicky Reinagle and her friend, which occurred in Bay Cliff, 6 miles away. Perhaps Belle had been planning to assault and murder them and became frustrated when it didn't work out, so after his legal situation with this incident was cleared up, he decided to target 2 other girls. So our final victim is Susie Bowers, and her case kind of sticks out because we have a 2.5-year gap between the disappearances of Brooke and Georgia and her murder. Since Belle never named Susie, she has only been classified as one of the 11 who went to heaven through process of elimination because her death happened to take place in that particular area and time period and has never been solved. This case does have a fairly compelling link to Belle, as he often visited a tugboat captain who lived behind Susie's grandparents' residence, so if Belle happened to go there on May the 21st, 1977, and saw Susie walking home alone, he could have taken advantage of the situation in order to abduct her. And here's one detail about Susie's murder which I find particularly odd. Decades later, when Catherine Casey interviewed Belle in prison for her book, Deliver Us, he openly talked about all the other 11 Went to Heaven murders, but when Casey asked him if he killed Susie Bowers, he simply sneered at her and never actually answered the question. For some unknown reason, hearing Susie's name seemed to set Belle off, as he abruptly ended the interview a short time later and told Casey that he would not see her anymore. I mean, this whole situation could be nothing more than Belle playing games and manipulating Casey for his own amusement, but if he was so willing to discuss the murders of other teenage girls, why would the mention of Susie Bowers cause him to clam up? What is it about her murder that stands out? Could it be possible that Belle was lying about all these other murders, and Susie was the only girl he did actually kill, making him reluctant to talk about it? But I guess trying to apply standard logic towards manipulative, narcissistic criminals like Belle is an exercise in futility. If Belle was actually a serial killer, then the circumstances of how he got arrested for the murder of Larry Dickens don't make much logical sense either. Think about it. He spent the better part of a decade murdering 11 victims without leaving any incriminating evidence behind or popping up on the radar as a suspect, yet he decides to expose himself and masturbate in front of a group of kids in a suburban neighborhood in broad daylight, which creates a huge risk of being caught. Even if Larry hadn't intervened, I doubt Belle would have abducted or murdered any of these children because there was such a large group of them. So with Belle, we have this weird divide between a cunning serial killer who knows how to get away with nearly a dozen murders and a compulsive sex offender with no self-control who likes to expose himself to children in public places. So what are we to make of this whole situation? Even though he confessed to all these murders, Belle claimed that he would not share the full truth about them until he was granted immunity from prosecution, which seems like a very bizarre thing to say when you're an elderly man already serving a 7-year prison sentence. But like I mentioned earlier, Belle still had the opportunity to receive parole, and he may have decided that he didn't want to jeopardize that, even though there was very little chance he would ever walk out of prison. But a recurring pattern with a lot of these convicted murderers is that the one thing they fear most when they go to prison is the possibility that they'll become irrelevant and fade into obscurity before they're completely forgotten about. Maybe after a couple of years behind bars, Bell felt the need to become the center of attention again, which is why he sent out confession letters to crimes he never actually committed. The fact that an entire TV series was produced about Bell, and we're still talking about him in the year 2023, even though he passed away 4 years ago, pretty much demonstrates that his strategy worked. Under normal circumstances, I would hate giving someone like him further attention, but since we still have a whole bunch of murdered victims whose cases have never been solved, we still have to explore the possibility that Bell was the perpetrator. But if Bell's confessions about the 11 who went to heaven were a complete fabrication, then the chilling alternate possibility is that someone else, perhaps a serial killer, got away with a number of murders. I can't say with 100% certainty that all 11 of these girls were murdered by the same person, but at least some of these crimes have to be connected. Back in the 1970s, nobody would have been thinking about DNA profiling or genetic genealogy, which is why it's a shame that most of the evidence wasn't preserved, meaning it will be difficult to conclusively solve these crimes after all these years. But even if the 11 who went to heaven was a gigantic hoax concocted by Bell, the silver lining is that it brought a lot of forgotten cold cases back into the spotlight again, and will increase the odds of someone coming forward with information. And if he was truly responsible for the murders of the 11 who went to heaven, then hopefully Edward Harold Bell went straight to hell. So if you happen to have any information about the murders of Debbie Ackerman, Maria Johnson, Rhonda Renee Johnson, Sharon Shaw, Brenda Jones, Colette Wilson, Gloria Gonzalez, Kimberly Pitchford, Brooks Bracewell, Georgia Gear, or Suzanne Bowers, please contact the appropriate authorities. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. This past month, we released a bonus episode about a fraud case from Unsolved Mysteries involving a man named Woody Kelly, who embezzled millions of dollars from his clients before he vanished without a trace, and he has not been seen for nearly 38 years. I've also dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, discuss another case from Unsolved Mysteries, the 1994 murders of Michael Johnston and Rochelle Robinson. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Ian B. and Daria J. Thank you so much for your support. Of course, later this year, The Trail Went Cold will be in attendance at two separate CrimeCon events. The first one is CrimeCon UK, which is returning to London and will be held at the Tower Bridge Leonardo Royal Hotel and Spa on June the 10th and 11th. And 2 months after that, I'll be attending the regular CrimeCon event, which will be held from September the 22nd to the 24th at the World Center Marriott in Orlando, Florida. Our podcast has a specialized promo code which can be used to get a special 10% discount on tickets, and this time around, the same code is valid for both events. So in order to purchase tickets and get a 10% discount, you can either visit crimecon.co.uk or crimecon.com and use the special promo code COOL23. That's COOL23. And if that wasn't enough, I will also be in attendance at this year's True Crime Podcast Festival, which is taking place from August the 25th to the 27th at the DoubleTree by Hilton Hotel in Austin, Texas. For more information about that event, please visit their website at truecrimepodcastfestival.com. I just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. And of course, I also need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. They've both been with me on this podcast for the entire 7 years and provided tremendous support, and I never would have gotten The Trail Went Cold off the ground without them. And if you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. Anyway, it's surreal to think that The Trail Went Cold has reached its 7-year anniversary milestone, and let me tell you, the time has just flown by. The world of podcasting and true crime in general has changed a lot during these past 7 years, but one thing which hasn't changed is the amazing support we have received and continue to receive from all our listeners. So thank you all so much for making this such an amazing ride for us. So have yourselves a great week and join us next Wednesday for our first brand new episode of Year 7 of The Trail Went Cold. We'll be right back.